A Vindication of the Rights of Woman by Mary Wollstonecraft, first published in 1792. The first half of Chapter 2, The Prevailing Opinion About Sexual Differences. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. To explain and excuse the tyranny of man, many ingenious arguments have been presented to prove that in the acquiring of virtue, the two sexes ought to have very different aims, or, to put it bluntly, women aren't thought to have enough strength of mind to acquire virtue, properly so called. But it would seem that if they have souls, there is only one way appointed by God to lead mankind to virtue or to happiness. If then women are not a swarm of insignificant ephemera, insects like mayflies that live for only one day, why should they be kept in ignorance under the pretty label innocence? Men complain, with reason, about the follies and whims of our sex, except when they sharply satirize our headstrong passions and grovelling vices. I would answer, behold the natural effect of ignorance. A mind that has only prejudices to rest on will always be unstable, and the current will run with destructive fury when there are no barriers to break its force. Women are told from their infancy, and taught by their mother's example, that a little knowledge of human weakness, properly called cunning, softness of temperament, outward obedience, and scrupulous attention to a puerile kind of propriety, will obtain for them the protection of man. And if they are also beautiful, that's all they need for at least 20 years. That is how Milton describes our first frail mother, Eve, though when he tells us that women are formed for softness and sweet attractive grace, I don't understand him, unless in true Moslem fashion he means to deprive us of souls, insinuating that all we were designed for was to use sweet attractive grace and docile blind obedience to gratify the senses of man when he can no longer soar on the wing of contemplation. Those who advise us only to turn ourselves into gentle domestic animals, how grossly they insult us. For instance, the winning softness that is so warmly and frequently recommended, that governs by obeying, what childish expressions! And a being who will sink to the level of governing by such underhand methods, what an insignificant being that must be! Can it be an immortal one? Certainly, says Lord Bacon. Man is of kin to the beasts by his body, and if he be not of kin to God by his spirit, he is a base and ignoble creature. Men, indeed, seem to me to act in a very unphilosophical manner when they try to secure the good conduct of women by keeping them always in a state of childhood. Rousseau was more consistent when he wanted to stop the progress of reason in both sexes, for if men eat fruit of the tree of knowledge, women will come in for a taste, but the imperfect cultivation that their understandings now receive will give them only a knowledge of evil. Children, I agree, should be innocent, but when innocent is applied to men or women, it is merely a polite word for weak. If it is granted that women were destined by Providence to acquire human virtues, and to use their understandings to achieve the stability of character that is the firmest ground to rest our future hopes on, then they must be permitted to look to the fountain of light, God, and not forced to steer by the twinkling of a mere satellite, man. Milton was of a very different opinion, but it would be hard to make consistent two passages that I am now going to contrast. But then, great men are often led by their senses into such inconsistencies. To whom thus Eve with perfect beauty adorned, my author and disposer, what thou bidst, unargued, I obey. So God ordains. God is thy law, thou mine. To know no more is woman's happiest knowledge and her praise. These are exactly the arguments I have used to children. But then I have added, your reason is now gaining strength. Until it arrives at some degree of maturity, you must look up to me for advice. But when it does arrive there, you ought to think and rely only on God. Yet, in these next lines, Milton seems to agree with me when he makes Adam protest to his Maker like this. Hast thou not made me here thy substitute? and these inferior far beneath me set? Among unequals, what society can sort, what harmony or delight, which must be mutual in proportion, due, given, and received, but in disparity, the one intense, the other still remiss, cannot well suit with either, but soon prove tedious alike, of fellowship I speak, such as I seek, fit to participate all rational delight. In discussing the manners of women, therefore, let us set aside sensual arguments, and work out what we should try to make women be, in order to cooperate, if the expression isn't too bold, with God. The sense of the word education isn't precisely defined, so I should explain. By individual education, I mean the kind of attention to a child that will slowly sharpen the senses, form the temperament, regulate the passions as they begin to bubble up, and set the understanding to work before the body reaches maturity, so that the fully mature man will only have to continue the important task of learning to think and reason, rather than having to start it. I don't believe that a private education can work the wonders that some optimistic writers have attributed to it. Men and women must be educated to a large extent by the opinions and manners of the society they live in. In every age there has been a stream of popular opinion that has carried everything along with it, giving to that age a family character, so to speak. So it's reasonable to conclude that until society is differently constituted, not much can be expected from education. All I need for my present purpose, however, is this. Whatever effect circumstances have on people's abilities, everyone can become virtuous by the exercise of his or her own reason. For if just one being was created with vicious inclinations, i.e., was created positively bad, what could save us from atheism? Or if we worshipped a god, wouldn't we be worshipping a devil? So the most perfect education, in my opinion, is the use of the understanding in the way that is most likely to strengthen the body and form the heart, i.e., to enable the individual to attain such habits of virtue as will render him or her independent. To describe as virtuous anyone whose virtues don't result from the exercise of his or her own reason is a farce. This was Rousseau's opinion regarding men. I extend it to women. Still, the royal homage that women receive is so intoxicating that, until manners in general come to be formed on more reasonable principles, it may be impossible to convince them that the illegitimate power that they get by degrading themselves is a curse, and that if they want to enjoy the peaceful satisfaction that unsophisticated affections impart, they must return to nature and equality. But for the present age, we must wait until kings and nobles, enlightened by reason and preferring the real dignity of man to their present childish state, throw off their gaudy hereditary trappings. If that happens, and women still don't resign the arbitrary power of beauty, they'll be showing that they have less mind than man. At the risk of seeming arrogant, I must declare my firm belief that everyone who has written about female education and manners, from Rousseau to Dr. Gregory, has helped to make women more artificial, weaker characters than they would otherwise have been, and consequently more useless members of society. I could have expressed this conviction in a lower key, but that would have been an insincere whine, and not the faithful expression of my feelings, of the clear conclusion that experience and reflection have led me to draw. When I come to the right place for that, I'll discuss the passages that I especially disapprove of in the works of the authors I have just mentioned. But this is the right place to remark that I object not just to isolated passages, but to the whole purport of those books, which I think tend to degrade one half of the human species and make women pleasing at the expense of every solid virtue. Reasoning on Rousseau's premises, we could say this. If man did achieve a degree of perfection of mind when his body arrived at maturity, it might be proper, so as to make a man and his wife one, that she should rely entirely on his understanding. Then the graceful female ivy, clasping the male oak that supported it, would form a whole in which strength and beauty would be equally conspicuous. But alas, husbands as well as their wives are often only overgrown children. Indeed, thanks to early debauchery, they are hardly grown men in their outward form. We don't need a messenger angel from heaven to tell us what happens when the blind lead the blind. In the present corrupt state of society, many causes collaborate to enslave women by cramping their understandings and sharpening their senses. One that silently does more harm than all the rest, perhaps, is their disregard of order. Do everything in an orderly manner is a most important precept, but women who, in general, receive only a disorderly kind of education, seldom attend to it with as much exactness as men do, because men, from their infancy, are broken into method. This negligent kind of guesswork prevents women from generalizing matters of fact, so what they did yesterday they do again today, merely because they did it yesterday. Guesswork? Well, isn't that the right word for the random exertions of a sort of instinctive common sense, never brought to the test of reason? This offhand neglect of the understanding in early life has worse consequences than is commonly supposed. The little knowledge acquired by women with strong minds is, for various reasons, more random and episodic than the knowledge of men. It is acquired more by sheer observations of real life than from relating individual observations to the results of experience, generalizing by theorizing what women learn, they learn by snatches. And, because learning for them is in general only a secondary thing, they don't pursue any one branch of learning with the persevering eagerness that is needed to give vigor to the faculties and clarity to the judgment. In the present state of society, a little learning is required to support the character of a gentleman, and boys are obliged to submit to a few years of intellectual discipline. But in the education of women, the development of the understanding is always subordinate to the acquiring of some physical accomplishment, even while enervated by confinement and false notions of modesty, the body is prevented from attaining that grace and beauty which relaxed, half-formed limbs never exhibit. Besides, having no serious scientific study, if women have natural soundness of judgment, it is turned too soon onto life and manners. They dwell on effects, without tracing them back to causes, and complicated rules to adjust behaviour are a weak substitute for simple principles. As a proof that education gives females this appearance of weakness, consider the example of military men, who are, as women are, sent into the world before their minds have been stored with knowledge or strengthened by principles. The results are similar. Soldiers acquire a little superficial knowledge, snatched from the muddy current of conversation, and by continually mixing with society, they gain what is termed knowledge of the world. This acquaintance with manners and customs has often been confused with knowledge of the human heart, but that honourable label can't be deserved by the crude fruit of casual observation, never brought to the test of judgment based on combining experience with theory. When the education has been the same, where is the difference between the sexes? The only difference I can see comes from the fact that soldiers are free to see more of life than women are. Standing armies can never consist of resolute, robust men. They may be well-disciplined machines, but they will seldom contain men moved by strong passions or with very vigorous faculties. And depth of understanding isn't found in an army more often than it is found among women. And the cause is the same. Furthermore, officers are also particularly attentive to their persons, and fond of dancing, crowded rooms, adventures, and mockery. As with the fair sex, the business of their lives is gallantry. They were taught to please, and they only live to please. Yet they are still regarded as superior to women, though it is hard to discover what their superiority consists in, other than what I have just mentioned. The great misfortune is that they both acquire manners before morals, and a knowledge of life before reflection gives them an acquaintance with the grand ideal outline of human nature. It naturally follows that they, satisfied with common nature, become a prey to prejudices and blindly submit to authority, simply believing what they are told. If they have any sense, it is a kind of instinctive fast uptake of social situations, but this fails when opinions are to be analysed or arguments are to be pursued below the surface. Riches and hereditary honours have made ciphers of women, and idleness has produced a mixture of gallantry and despotism in society, which leads men who are slaves of their mistresses to tyrannise over their sisters, wives, and daughters. Strengthen the female mind by enlarging it, and that will bring an end to blind obedience. But because blind obedience is always sought for by power, tyrants and sensualists are right to try to keep women in the dark. The tyrants only want slaves, and the sensualists only want toys. In fact, sensualists have been the most dangerous tyrants, and women have been duped by their lovers, as princes are by their ministers, while dreaming that they reigned over them. I am principally thinking of Rousseau, and specifically of his work on education entitled Emile. His character Sophie in that book is a captivating one, no doubt, though it strikes me as grossly unnatural. But what I am planning to attack is not the superstructure, but the foundation of her character, the principles on which her education was built. Warmly as I admire the genius of that able writer, indignation always takes the place of admiration when I read his voluptuous daydreams. Is this the man who, in his ardour for virtue, wants to banish all the soft arts of peace and almost carry us back to Spartan discipline? Is this the man who loves to portray the useful struggles of passion, the triumphs of good dispositions, and the heroic flights that carry the glowing soul out of itself? How are these mighty sentiments lowered when he describes the pretty foot and the enticing airs of his little favourite? But I'll set that aside for just now, and merely remark that whoever has cast a benevolent eye on society must often have been gratified by the sight of humble mutual love, not dignified by sentiment or strengthened by a union in intellectual pursuits. The domestic trifles of the day have provided material for cheerful conversation, and innocent caresses have softened toils which didn't require great exercise of mind or stretch of thought. But hasn't the sight of this middling happiness aroused more tenderness than respect? It is an emotion like what we feel when we see children playing, whereas the contemplation of the noble struggles of suffering merit has created admiration and carried our thoughts to that world where sensation will give place to reason. So women are to be considered either as moral beings or as so weak that they must be entirely subjected to the superior faculties of men. Let us examine this question. Rousseau declares that a woman should never for a moment feel herself to be independent, that she should be governed by fear to exercise her natural cunning, and make a coquettish slave in order to make her a more alluring object of desire, a sweeter companion to man whenever he chooses to relax himself. He carries his arguments, which he claims to infer from the indications of nature, still further, and indicates that truth and fortitude, the cornerstones of all human virtue, should be cultivated with certain restrictions, because with respect to the female character, obedience is the great lesson which ought to be impressed on the woman with unrelenting rigour. What nonsense! When will a great man arise with enough strength of mind to puff away the fumes that pride and sensuality have thus spread over the subject? If women are by nature inferior to men, their virtues must be comparable with men's, meaning that they must be the same in quality if not in degree. So their conduct should be based on the same principles as men's conduct, and should have the same aim. Connected with man as daughters, wives, and mothers, the moral character of women may be judged by how they fulfil those simple duties. But the great end of their exertions should be to develop their own faculties and acquire the dignity of conscious virtue. They may try to make their road pleasant, but they should never forget, as men do, that life doesn't yield the happiness that can satisfy an immortal soul. I don't mean to imply that either sex should be so lost in abstract reflections or distant views as to forget the affections and duties that lie before them and are indeed the means appointed to produce the fruit of life. On the contrary, I warmly recommend them, even while I say, that they give most satisfaction when they are considered in their true subordinate light. The dominant opinion that woman was created for man may have been inferred from Moses' poetical story, but presumably very few who have thought about the subject ever believed that Eve was literally one of Adam's ribs, so that inference must be dropped, or be admitted only as proving that from the remotest antiquity man found it convenient to exert his strength, to subjugate his companion, and his invention to show that she ought to have her neck bent under the yoke, because she, as well as the lower animals, was created to do his pleasure. Don't think that I want to invert the order of things. I have already conceded that the constitution of men's bodies, I am speaking collectively of the whole sex, seem to indicate that God designed them to attain a greater degree of virtue than women. But I don't see the faintest reason to conclude that their virtues are different in kind from women's. How could they be, if virtue has only one eternal standard? If I am to be consistent in my reasoning, therefore, I must put as much energy into maintaining, with regard to male virtue and female virtue, that they have the same simple direction as I put into maintaining that there is a God. It follows from this that I mustn't set up a contrast between female cunning and male wisdom, little female cares and great male exertions, or insipid female softness, varnished over with the label gentleness, and the male fortitude that can only be inspired by grand views. I shall be told that if women aimed at the same virtues as men, woman would then lose many of her special graces, and the line I am taking here might be attacked by quoting from a well-known poet, Alexander Pope, who has said on behalf of the whole male sex, "Yet near so sure are passions to create, as when she touched the brink of all we hate." I'll leave it to you to decide in what light this joke places men and women. And in the meanwhile, I'll content myself with remarking that I can't discover why females should always be degraded by being made subservient to love or lust, unless they are mortal. Yes, yes, speaking disrespectfully of love is committing high treason against sentiment and fine feelings. But I want to speak the simple language of truth, addressing the head rather than the heart. To try to reason love out of the world would be pointless, and contrary to common sense. But it appears less wild to try, as I shall, to restrain this tumultuous passion, and to prove that it shouldn't be allowed to dethrone superior powers or grab the sceptre that should always be wielded, coolly, by the understanding. Youth is the season for love in both sexes, but in those days of thoughtless enjoyment, one should prepare for the more important years of life, when reflection takes place of sensation. But Rousseau, and most of his male followers, have strongly maintained that the whole tendency of female education ought to be directed towards one goal, to make women pleasing. If you support that opinion, let me reason with you. Do you imagine that marriage can eradicate the habits of life? The woman who has only been taught to please will soon find that her charms are oblique sunbeams, and that they can't have much effect on her husband's heart when he sees them every day, and when the summer of her physical beauty is past and gone. When that happens, she may have enough energy to look into herself for comfort and cultivate the faculties she has idled. Or she may instead try to please other men, and try in the emotions raised by the expectation of new conquests, to forget how her love or pride has been humiliated. Which do you think is more likely? When the husband has stopped being a lover, and that time will inevitably come, her desire to please will weaken, or become a spring of bitterness, and love, perhaps the least durable of all the passions, will give place to jealousy or vanity. End of the first half of chapter 2.